I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. We begin today talking politics with Washington Post syndicated columnist E.J. Dionne. In a recent essay, he asserts that as the Trump administration lurches along chaotically, the left has seized the agenda with a host of policy ideas that may find appeal outside traditional Democratic strongholds in metropolitan areas. The Democratic caucus stayed unified during the shutdown fight with President Trump, but as bipartisan talks on border security get underway today, will the Democrats find consensus among themselves regarding immigration policy, to say nothing of reaching agreement with Trump and the Republicans? Plus, the incredible journey of a symphony musician in New Mexico from homelessness in Baltimore to professional success. We'll meet Richard White today on Midday. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. We start today talking politics with E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. The State of the Union speech was to have taken place last night. It was rescheduled for next Tuesday. It's the first time since 1986 that a State of the Union has been delayed, when Ronald Reagan was slated to address Congress on the same day as the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster. The longest government shutdown in U.S. history, which ended on Friday, was a disaster of a different kind, not only for the estimated 800,000 federal workers who missed two paychecks, but perhaps also for the reputation of the American institutions charged with the basic task of governing. E.J. Dionne writes in a recent column, the Trump shutdown fiasco is a symptom of the exhaustion of the conservative agenda. The intellectual and policy energy is now on the left and center left. The real wall is between the political right and fresh ideas. Always a man with a plethora of fresh ideas, E.J. Dionne joins us on the line from his home near Washington, D.C. His latest book is called One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported, which he co-authored with Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann. E.J., it's good to talk to you, sir. Welcome back.
What a joy to be with you always. Thanks for those very kind words. And also, thanks for letting me do this from home this morning. If your listeners hear a dog bark, it is our faithful dog, Casey.
Well, we welcome you and Casey to the show. Always glad to have you. You did an event at the Brookings Institute the other day about the State of the Union. It was scheduled to be a sort of, you know, preview of what you thought the president would talk about. It ended up being a conversation about whether a State of the Union is even necessary. And a couple of folks on the panel came down on the side that we really don't need States of the Union addresses anymore. You came down in favor. Why is that?
I think, you know, if you really believe in diminishing presidential power, or if you really don't want to enhance the power of the person who is currently our president, then there is a good case to be made against the State of the Union address. There is also something, you know, it's a set piece thing, and the other problem with it is that our political polarization is such that people tend not to listen anymore to a speech by a president they disagree with. That's been true of presidents of both parties. But against all of that, I come back and argue a couple of things. One is, it's really good to force a president of any kind to sit down and say, here is my agenda. What is the president for? What is he going to push for in the current year? Second, it does call for a reckoning with where the country stands, and having a, you know, at a given moment, and having an argument about how we're doing, what is the State of the Union, is actually a good small d Democratic thing to do. The third thing is that even though those immediate party responses to whoever the incumbent president is are really difficult to do, and only a handful of them have been successful, it does give the opposition party at least some chance to say, here's what's wrong with the president's agenda, and here's what we propose. So despite all the problems, I still think it's a useful exercise.
Do you know why it is that Nancy Pelosi wouldn't allow it to go ahead last night? I mean, the government had reopened. She moved it to next Tuesday. Is there any intrigue to be deciphered from that?
As far as I can tell, no, there isn't an intrigue. I think there was a real concern that having shut the whole thing down and given how complicated these things are to stage and given the importance of security in this era, it made more sense to delay it. My own view is I think it probably should have been delayed until after we settled the issue of whether we were going to close the government again. But I think there was a judgment that you just couldn't keep kicking this down the road. So she is agreeing to give him a platform while the parties and the White House are in still in negotiations over border security and that wall. So in some sense, she is giving Trump a real opportunity here.
You said something at Brookings the other day that I thought was really insightful. You say Trump is an incumbent who behaves as if he's in the opposition. And that, I think that's really true.
It's true, and that it's one of the remarkable things all along about Trump is that he inherited a good economy from President Obama. The job growth has continued. Wage growth has happened to some degree, which is really something to brag about, even if it's not what it should be, and even if people in the middle and the bottom haven't gotten a lot during the Trump presidency. He could put a fairly positive light on the country. Instead, he constantly goes back to use that very evocative phrase in his inaugural address, American carnage. He has to act like we are in a crisis, like matters at the border are worse than ever, when in fact they're not worse than ever. He constantly has to make people fearful and upset because that's how he believes his core constituency feels about the country right now. So that's why I said he's an incumbent who acts like the opposition. He perpetually wants to be in the opposition. And I also think that characterologically or perhaps tactically, he thinks being on the attack is always a better play for him than trying to present an optimistic, here's how we're going to solve our problems approach. I suspect you will see some bragging on the economy in this State of the Union. I can't imagine he won't try to do that. But I think he just depends upon inciting anxieties in the country to keep his hold on those voters he still has a hold on.
And it does seem that when it comes to this conversation about border security, and there's a bipartisan group meeting about that at this hour to try to work something out to avoid another shutdown on the 15th of February, that the president has sort of stated his piece and he's staying out of it. He said he wants a border wall and he wants $5.7 billion for it, and that's that. And then he's leaving it to Congress to work out the details. What do you make of that play?
Well, I think partly the Republicans have said to him, and there was a very good story in the Washington Post, I'm touting my own newspaper here, that talked about a Senate Republican luncheon where Republicans were at each other's throats and at the throats of the administration saying, why did you put us in this mess? And the shutdown, if you looked at the polling, was very bad for Trump and very bad for the Republicans. And I think he's hanging back, holding out this possibility that he would invoke emergency powers to shift money toward his wall if Congress doesn't give him the money. And I think that, his own party is, for the first time, really, in some ways, prepared to pull back from him. I thought it was significant that six Republicans voted for the Democratic proposal in the Senate, simply to forget the wall, let's just open the government. That's a lot of defections, given how loyal Republicans have been to Trump so far.
Yeah, that's more than voted for the Republican plan. I mean, the Democratic plan actually got a few more votes.
Yeah,
I mean,
two more votes. It was the Republican plan got 50 votes. The Democratic plan got 52 votes. And I when I saw that, I felt, okay, I think this is the beginning of the end. Not all my predictions are right, by the way. I freely concede that, but that one was.
Is it possible, do you think, that McConnell and the Senate would come up with a plan that Trump may not want necessarily, but that they would pass it and override a veto if Mr. Trump decided to go that way?
I think what may come out of this, Hakeem Jeffries, who is the chair of the Democratic caucus, he's a rising star among House Democrats, has been saying, using the phrase enhanced fencing, and no one believes that there should be no boundaries of some kind, no fences at the border. And I think one way out of this might be for Trump to redefine. He's redefined the wall over and over again. Nancy Pelosi met with a group of columnists last week and pointed to some flowers in her office and say, you know, he might consider these flowers a wall at this point. And so maybe they'll come around to the Democrats saying, we won't give you a wall, but of course we know some of the fencing needs to be reinforced, and he can declare, see, they gave in on the wall. The problem for Trump is that his strongest supporters on the anti-immigration right have already shown that they will not give him any slack on the wall. And that's why I still think he will be very tempted to resort to those emergency powers.
Well, Nancy Pelosi, who just a few weeks ago, people were wondering whether or not she'd be able to prevail in a vote for Speaker, certainly reasserted herself with a vengeance in this past month. She was able to keep the caucus together, the Democratic caucus together. But do the Democrats themselves have consensus about border policy in general and border security in particular? And do you think that the Speaker, in a way, sort of boxed herself in by framing the wall as a moral issue rather than, talking about its efficacy and its efficacy versus other methods of border security? I mean, have the Democrats painted themselves in as much of a corner as the president appears to have?
I think they're in much less of a corner at this point than he is. First of all, I think Pelosi was able to keep Democrats united because there really was a strong view across the party that they simply could not give in to what they commonly called hostage taking, that any concessions to Trump in a situation where he closed down the government to get what he wanted would only invite him to do it again. And so, what was significant is not only did Pelosi keep her caucus together, but there was absolutely no daylight between Pelosi and the Democratic leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer. And it was a reminder that even though the Democrats are a minority in the Senate, in a situation where 60 votes are required for almost everything, although significantly not for confirming judges, by the way, they have quite a lot of power. Yes, the Democrats are not all of one mind on this. There are a lot of Democrats from moderate suburban districts who asked Pelosi to make very clear that Democrats are for border security, too. And Pelosi responded to that with a big package. It's very possible Democrats will agree to as much or more money than Trump asked for border security, just not for the wall. On that immoral thing, yeah, there's a case, I think, that declaring a piece of construction moral or immoral can be problematic. But I think there is an underlying point that she was making that at least I agree with, which is the wall has become the symbol of something that is immoral, which is the notion that we're going to keep out certain kinds of people from America. It's a walk away from the idea that we are a nation that, despite a lot of outbreaks of nativism and a lot of arguments over the decades, in the end comes down to the fact that we're enriched by immigration much more than we are hurt by it. And so I think that's what she was saying.
And you write in a recent column that Mr. Trump has asked his blue-collar loyalists to live on a diet of rhetoric and empty symbols, the border wall being symbol number one. Trump's deteriorating poll numbers showed that all but the most extreme of his supporters were losing faith in that project. So we're going to take a little bit of a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about whether or not the left has, in fact, sort of taken over when the intellectual arena for policy ideas and new ideas on a variety of issues. You make a really compelling case for that in the column. E.J. Dionne is a longtime syndicated columnist for The Washington Post. He's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a professor in the Foundations of Democracy and Culture program at Georgetown University. He co-authored his latest book with Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann. It's called One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. It's now available in paperback. If you haven't read it, I can only imagine how embarrassed you are. If you'd like to apologize to Mr. Dionne in person, you can do that when we come back. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're tuned to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, a Super Bowl preview with our resident sports guru, Mark Hyman, and Stan the Fan, Stan Charles, who presides over the PressBox digital network. The NFL is reeling from the controversial non-call in the NFC Championship game. And as popular as the Super Bowl is, there are many who think the long-term future of the league may be under threat because of the paucity of insurance companies who are willing to insure the league against debilitating injuries. So we'll talk about that with Mark and Stan as well. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review Company at Baltimore's Still Point Theater. If you're just joining us today, we're talking politics with E.J. Dionne of the Brookings Institution and the Washington Post. He is the author of 7 books, most recently One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported, which he co-wrote with Norm Ornstein and Thomas Mann. If you'd like to join our conversation with E.J. Dionne, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWYPR. So, EJ, a recent column when you talked about the bubbling up of all sorts of different kinds of policy ideas that are accompanying the announcements for various people running for president. We're now at, I think, 9 declared candidates on the Democratic side and several more to come. It seems sometimes that maybe you and me and your dog Casey are the only sentient beings on the planet not running for the Democratic nomination for president. It's going to be
Tom, you should think about it. I mean, you're very thoughtful and you ask good questions, so you should, maybe your listeners can create a draft movement. I mean, why not?
Yeah, since when did those two things matter for being president? But, you know, when you have folks like Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris, Sherrod Brown, who's likely to, you know, throw his hat in the ring, Mayor Buttigieg, is that how you say his name? It's South Bend?
Buttigieg,
okay. Kristen Gillibrand. They are proposing a number of things. Has the attention and the sort of intellectual heft really shifted from the right to the left?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I am old enough to remember the 1970s, the late 1970s. And that was a period when, even though at the time I thought some of these ideas or many of these ideas were flawed, it was widely written with some reason that intellectual energy was on the right and that liberals had gotten a little tired in their thinking. And that combined with a backlash against some of the problems under Jimmy Carter, a very, very decent man we should never forget, but we had some real problems in the late 70s, this created a real intellectual energy behind conservatism. And I think what's going on now, which is widely described as a sharp shift leftward among Democrats, and there is certainly the party is to the left of where it was, say, in 1992, but I don't think a sharp shift leftward captures it nearly as much as the idea that the conservatives are really out of ideas and that there's an offensive now on the left, an ideological offensive, to say, wait a minute, supply side economics never worked. Progressive taxes are a good idea. Thus, you have all these various proposals to shift the tax burden in one way or another toward the well-off. We have been woefully slow in dealing with very big problems, whether you are talking about the problems of work and family. Our family leave system and our child care system is just way behind what exists in the other democracies. Whether you're talking about health care, where we Obamacare took a big step forward, but we still have people uninsured. That what you have is a lot of bubbling up on the center left and left. And something struck me this week about how you move the political spectrum back in a different direction. Elizabeth Warren came out with her proposal for a wealth tax, and back came the Washington Post editorial board and Steve Rattner in the New York Times saying, no, this isn't the right way to do it, but we should raise the capital gains tax. Suddenly, the debate is between a moderate idea, in quotes, which is raising capital gains taxes, which we haven't talked about in a long time. I mean, there was a little bit of it in Obamacare, but now that is the moderate position. I think that's a symptom of a whole political spectrum being pulled away from this right-wing ideology. And in the meantime, what do Republicans have to talk about? A corporate tax cut and a wall. And I think the wall is symptomatic of how empty their intellectual quiver is right now.
And when Mr. Trump ran, he talked often about the forgotten men and women who were no longer forgotten. Are any of these ideas, or all of these ideas, pegged towards those voters who became disillusioned, those voters who perhaps did vote for Mr. Obama and then switched and voted for Mr. Trump in 2016? Is this a response to the oft-repeated paradigm that Hillary Clinton somehow didn't connect at, or respond to the needs of these marginalized middle-class voters?
I think there is a response. I mean, anybody who reads my column knows how strongly opposed I am to President Trump. But there are some good things that could come out of this, assuming we survive the next 2 years. Thing one is the mobilization of an extraordinary number of people into the political system, into political activism, and the extraordinary turnout in the 2018 election. But another is that problems we should have been aware of are now on the agenda. There is a great inequality, not just among people, not just across races, but also across places. And there are two kinds of places that have been hit very hard by deindustrialization and the way in which this new economy works. One, which has been there for a long time, is the inner city. We look at Baltimore, a great city that was really hit very hard by the collapse of industrial work. And so we've been talking about this problem in the inner city for a long time, although we haven't done nearly enough about it. And now we're seeing that the problems that were there have now spread to places like Reading, Pennsylvania, and Erie, Pennsylvania, and places in Wisconsin and upstate New York and Michigan. And it's time we talked about these kinds of inequalities. Now, my great hope, speaking as somebody who admired Robert Kennedy, is that we could find a way to talk about these problems in a unifying rather than a divisive way. That these problems, as I said, have hit African Americans in the inner city, Latinos in many places, and also white working class people. And I think the task on the progressive side is to sort of describe, discuss, and propose solutions to these problems that can bring these groups together. And in the process, win back some of the people I've taken to calling Trump Democrats who may have strayed to him because they were simply fed up. None of this is to deny that Trump didn't also appeal to racial feeling and racism. But I think there is a share of the Trump vote that was primarily motivated by saying, I'll take a flyer on this guy, even if he's a little crazy, because I'm just so angry. I think those voters are up for grabs, and they shifted Democratic in Wisconsin and in Michigan and in Pennsylvania in the last election.
And of course, here in Maryland, something very different happened because the Democratic Party in Maryland nominated in Ben Jealous a very progressive Democrat, very much to the left of center. He was walloped by the incumbent Republican Governor Larry Hogan, who ran on a platform of bipartisanship and common sense ideas. Mr. Hogan has a piece in your newspaper, The Post, yesterday about how both sides, the Democrats and the president, abandoned their responsibility and obligation to work together and solve the problems that led to the shutdown. If the state of Maryland, which is so heavily Democratic, didn't feel obliged to move to the progressive side of the Democratic Party, what makes anybody think that the country at large would be willing to do that?
First of all, I want to say that I've really respected Ben Jealous for a long time, going back to his days at the NAACP. And I think you saw a really interesting thing on Election Day, which is three of the strongest Republicans on the ballot were Republican governors in Maryland, Governor Hogan, in Massachusetts, and in Vermont. All three of these Republican governors were very strongly anti-Trump Republicans and presented a very different picture of Republicanism than most of the rest of the party did nationally. And so, one can argue there can be a debate about how left can the Democrats go and still win the election. But I actually think in each of these cases, the vote for Republicans from a lot of Democrats, obviously you can't win in Maryland as a Republican unless you get a lot of Democratic votes, were actually endorsing a different approach to politics in the Republican Party. And so I think it's very useful that Governor Hogan is out there talking about a challenge to Trump in the Republican Party. I don't honestly see, given how the party is constituted these days, that such a challenge could succeed. But I think it's very important that there be Republicans out there who say that the extremism of the Trump presidency is not what the party should be about.
EJ, let's see if we can sneak a call or two in. Let's go to Kevin in Abington. Kevin, welcome to Midday with EJ Dion.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm a 64-year-old African-American male, okay? I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller. And
welcome.
I would just like to speak very briefly on what this wall thing is really all about and why Donald Trump is so afraid. The reality is that within the next 30 to 40 years, the Caucasian race is diminishing. And it has to do with racial purity, basically. When I was a kid back in the 50s and 60s, growing up in Baltimore, we had white people, we had black people. Now, I'm just being very candid, okay? We had white people, we had black people. Now we have all kinds of mixed nationalities in our society. And this wall is to protect the purity of the white race.
Yeah, well, Kevin, I appreciate that comment. And EJ, Kevin is not alone in that understanding of what Mr. Trump's motivation is. And a lot of people impute the same, the people who are supporting Mr. Trump, they impute that very strict racial bias to them as well.
Well, first of all, thank you to the caller. And this goes back to what we were talking about earlier. I think when Pelosi used the word immoral, refer to the wall, she was talking about that very sentiment. And I think President Trump gave a lot away, maybe it was about a year ago, when he said, I'd have no problem with more immigrants from Norway. Now, what does that tell us? I'm not sure he wants a lot of social democrats or socialists from Norway to come to America. Obviously, there is to put it very gently, a racial element to a comment like that. So I do think there's something to that. I have this conversation with my conservative friends all the time, saying that this attitude toward immigration and color and ethnicity seems to me very inconsistent with a view that says America is a great country that has brought in all sorts of people who become American. We forget that when the Irish were coming in, that immigration was racialized as well. A friend of mine who's a scholar of these things sort of pointed me to some anti-Irish cartoons back in the 1840s and 1850s, which basically said that Irish immigrants are just like African Americans. African Americans weren't described so kindly in these racist anti-immigrant publications. So we've gone through this. I believe in the power of America as an idea, so that all of us, regardless of our color and background, and the color is, by the way, absolutely right, we also have more and more people of mixed heritage in our country. I think our country's ideas are strong enough that we will continue to get along no matter what shades of skin color we have in our population. And so, in a sense, I don't want to put words in the caller's mouth, but I suspect he and I may have more confidence in the American idea than people who want to racialize all of our problems.
William sends us an email and says the best argument against the wall comes from the Heritage Foundation, which is not exactly a bastion of leftiness, and they found it not cost-effective except where low melting points, where they can quickly melt into local communities. They say use agents and have high tech. And, of course, a number of people subscribe to that as well. Byron says, I'm a fan of Mr. Dion's commentary on NPR. How do you feel the media should cover, he says, hopefully soon to be former President Trump? Mr. Trump certainly changed the paradigm for a presidential election in 2016. The Democrats are saying they learned something. What have the media learned? What should we know this time around that we didn't know the last time?
Well, we talk about this in our book, if I could just mention the book briefly on behalf of my dear co-authors. It was really shocking when you looked back at how much free television time Trump got, particularly early on in the campaign, where the media, particularly television media, realize that Trump is ratings, not only because of the people who are for him, but also the people who couldn't stand him. And sometimes empty podiums waiting for Trump got more coverage than all of the other Republican candidates. And I think this is an objection that should come not only from liberals who thought Trump got too much uncritical attention, but also from Republicans, other Republicans who got drowned out by Trump. Secondly, I've always joked that Trump is the only candidate in history who pushed back against one scandal with a new scandal. And I think there was, in my view, and again, I'm very anti-Trump, I think that there was a weird effort to balance, to say that Hillary Clinton is as flawed as Donald Trump is. Now, there are plenty of things you can say critical of Hillary Clinton, but I think in retrospect, this was a kind of false balance. Hillary Clinton had the flaws that most normal politicians have. Donald Trump is something else altogether, and I think we've seen that in the last 2 years. Now, one heartening thing to me is that the media have gotten more and more willing to call a lie a lie. And the media have now taken it on themselves rightly to catalog all the lies that President Trump says offers us consistently and to do some of it in real time. So I think the coverage is toughening up. But I think there's a whole debate about false balance. And you know, my colleague at the Washington Post, Margaret Sullivan, has a great column that just went up this morning about how sort of pretending that the center, there is some center that is clearly better automatically than arguments on either side of it, is itself a form of bias. And I think that's something else that needs to be examined. I tweeted out her column this morning. I commend it to people.
I commend it as well. I think it's really excellent. So, EJ, I know you're on deadline. We got to let you go. But let me ask you one more question, and that's about Roger Stone. He's the sixth person in the sort of close inner circle of Mr. Trump to be indicted or convicted of crimes in the Mueller investigation. There are a couple of dozen folks further outside the circle who've had the same fate. Is this, to your reckoning, in any way an inflection point for the investigation or for Mr. Trump himself, given the longevity of Mr. Stone's relationship with Mr. Trump and the very heavy influence that he's exercised as an advisor to Mr. Trump for decades now? Is there anything different about Roger Stone being indicted than Cohen or Flynn or some of the others?
I gave up long ago on pretending to know where the inflection points are in either the Trump presidency or the Mueller investigation. I think it is a very significant indictment, obviously, because this goes straight to cooperation with WikiLeaks, who were peddling stolen information, and that information was stolen by the Russians. So it takes us a step closer to the question of collusion. And I don't know where Mueller is going with this. There are those who are saying, see, he still doesn't have collusion. But I think it was, I can't remember if it was the Post or the New York Times recently, who talked about, you know, scores and scores of meetings with Trump people and Trump campaign people or people around the campaign and the Russians. And I think we are approaching the end of the Mueller investigation, but I'll be damned if I know when it's ending, and I'm never going to predict the end until I see a notice for a news conference by Mueller.
Yeah, you and me both, babe. Let me tell you, it's, you know, reading tea leaves with Mr. Mueller is one difficult task. E.J. Dionne is a longtime columnist for The Washington Post, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and the author of seven books, including his latest one, which I loved, called One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. He co-wrote them with Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann. E.J., always great to talk to you. Look forward to the next time. Thanks.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Coming up after a quick break, Dr. Richard White joins me. He's an accomplished musician, a member of the New Mexico Philharmonic, and a professor at the University of New Mexico. His journey to professional success began in an unlikely way, as a homeless child in Sandtown, Winchester. A new documentary chronicles his extraordinary story. He joins me right after this break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.